This episode is brought to you by Book Riot Insiders. Bag your bookish perks with a 14-day free trial of Book Riot Insiders. Sign up for a monthly or yearly novel subscription, and the first 14 days are free. You can wishlist upcoming releases you're dying to read, get exclusive podcasts and newsletters, enter to win swag, and access our new release index curated by All the Books host and Velocireader extraordinaire Liberty Hardy. It'll help you keep track of the most exciting upcoming books. So come on in. Your bag of bookish perks is waiting. Go to bookriot.com/insiders to find out more. This is the Book Riot Podcast, a weekly news and talk show about what's new, cool, and worth talking about in the world of books and reading. This is episode 287, recording on Thursday, November 15th. I'm Rebecca Shinsky, here with Jeff O'Neill. We're coming to you from bookriot.com.
It's sort of the deep breath before the plunge of the holidays right now.
It is. Yeah.
It's time. And we just realized that we actually submerged before we took a breath for this. So next week is the first of our annual, two episodes, so back-to-back weeks, we'll be doing this holiday recommendation show. So if you would like to get a customized holiday recommendation request from Rebecca and I, could be for you. Could be for someone you want to give as a you're buying a gift for, you just want to know something. We are taking recommendation requests. Email us at podcast@bookriot.com. The first wave, you know, probably your best bet to get one in. Sometimes we don't get to all of them because we get a lot. Would be to get them to us by Saturday, which would be November 24th. podcast@bookriot.com. We'll take a wave, and if we have room for more, we'll let you know on that episode. These are always fun episodes to do. I hope you like nonfiction.
please tell me you need books about yoga.
Yeah, right. No, but we'll deploy all our skills and all our strengths, as Corleone says in The Godfather, to do what we can to give you great requests.
Yeah. We've read some books.
Yeah, we're
going to be fine.
We have. We got plenty of books, and we've read a bunch of books. So podcast@bookriot.com, get them in. We'll try to see what we can do. Always a fun show. So there's that. Before we get into it, I have follow-up, but I think the follow-up will be more than regular follow-up. So let's do our first sponsor while we're here. It's Julian is a Mermaid, which, excellent title, from Candlewick Press. So here's what it's about. It's a story of love and acceptance. It encourages kids and adults to embrace differences and have empathy for others. It defies gender stereotypes, ties in with the Coney Island Mermaid Parade, and got five-starred reviews, including Kirk's five-star reviews, calling it charmingly subversive. It's by Jessica Love, and it's her debut. She's a Broadway actress with a studio art degree from UC Santa Cruz and a graduate degree from Juilliard. That's not too bad.
That's pretty fancy.
She says, this is what inspired Julian is a Mermaid. I used to date someone who had an older brother who was trans who came out to his family later in life. I remember there being questions about how to explain this transition to the kids in the family. It made me curious about what sorts of books were out there for families who wanted to talk to their kids about gender and identity. I wanted to make a book that held the space for those conversations without being prescriptive about how they should go. I have to confess, I picked up this book for my kids. We haven't talked about it yet. Kind of thing I want them plugged into from an early age to make these kinds of identities and these kinds of stories something that won't feel foreign to them, won't feel exotic, won't feel something they're afraid of, something they won't be comfortable about, something they won't see as other in some kind of way. So that's Julian is a Mermaid. It's out now from Candlewick Press by Jessica Love. Go check that out. Highly recommend it. Go check it. Tell your library to go buy it if they don't have it, so it's available for other people. Yeah. That's another way we can use these ad spots. Go get your library to buy it.
This is going on my list of things to buy for nieces and nephews for the holidays.
Not a lot of books out there like this. So there you go. Listener feedback.
We got follow-up.
So we got an email about W.H. Smith. We got some people telling us, slacking on Twitter, you know, filling in the gaps of our knowledge about W.H. Smith, and the gap being sort of basically the Grand Canyon, if you can call the Grand Canyon a gap in our knowledge about W.H. Smith. A lot of interesting things coming out about it. I guess I'll start here. So I guess it relates to something else you put in Slack too, maybe we'll talk about, but W.H. Smith was rated UK's worst high street shop by a group of readers from some magazine I've never heard of that's in the UK. High Street, if you don't know, it is not where they sell marijuana in the UK. It's just like Main Street brick and mortar retailer. It's its own, their own language, you know. They speak English okay over there. It's a couple of weird stuff that they do with our beautiful American language, but here we go. It has 10,000 shoppers to rate their experience in buying non-grocery items at 100 major retailers for the past 5 years, and there you go. It came in last. So it's hard to say. It's expensive. The stores are old. It's a down market situation. So there you go. I'm not sure what to do with that. It gives us some additional context. On the other hand, yeah. Anything you want to say about this story, Rebecca?
This was a related piece. One of our contributors, Ra, was telling us that they were listening to the podcast and, you know, feeling very like, oh, you know, W.H. Smith is the worst. And then realized that they were having this thought on the way home from a trip to W.H. Smith. And then they were like, well, that's about as indicative of the experience as you can get.
Right.
Like necessities, I go there, but ugh.
Yeah, in that regard, it reminds me, again, it doesn't do the same thing, but the sort of headspace that a lot of Americans consumers might hold for like the Walgreens of the world, the Duane Reeds of the world. Like, you're not like super pumped to go to Walgreens, and yet you find yourself going there because you just, it's available,
you need it.
Yeah. They're around. There you go. The related piece of follow-up, though, which I kind of found more interesting was, that apparently W.H. Smith is opening some stores that are dedicated to books. So as we talked about last time, I'll put these in the show notes. It's no slideshow. This is from Christopher who emailed us, but there's some links. They're called The Bookshop by W.H. Smith, and they look like they're small bookstores, really look smaller than your average indie, or maybe on the, if you think of it as like a small indie, a little more corporate looking, but you know, wooden bookshelves, and they're pretty much packed. But they only sell books, and they seem to be designed to be a lot closer in feel to Waterstones, and seem to be doing pretty well. So in our, I guess in our alternate universe where we didn't get sort of a boardroom showdown, you know, pissing match over at B&N, and this W.H. Smith acquisition actually went through, you might imagine that Barnes & Noble became the bookshop.
Yeah.
Which...
Yeah, that's interesting.
There you go. So, there we know a little bit more about what didn't almost happen, I guess.
Should we talk more about this Barnes & Noble desperation?
Yes. You texted to me this the other day, then put it in Slack. What did you discover out there in the wild?
So I went to Barnes & Noble on Tuesday to pick up Michelle Obama's new book. And there's a giant banner in the front window of my Barnes & Noble. I think it's in most, if not all of them now, from what I've heard on Slack with our insiders, that says, number one most reputable retailer in America, according to the Reputation Institute's 2018 U.S. Retail Rep Track Rankings. Barnes & Noble is listed number one, but then they list 2 through 5.
An odd move.
It is an odd move. Like, you know, why do you remind people of
well,
your competitors?
Well, and tell them why it's weird, because who's number two?
Because number two is Amazon.
Yeah, that's right.
And then the rest of the list is interesting. Like, you know, it would be, I think this is one thing if it's like most reputable, you know, bookshop in America or whatever, but Barnes & Noble, Amazon, Cabela's, AutoZone, and Costco. And like that's just this is a very American assortment of retailers for in terms of big box kinds of things. But I think when I texted it to you, it was like, methinks Barnes & Noble does protest too much. Like, how bad are things when you're like, you know, the way we're going to get business is put banners in the windows about how reputable we are. It feels to me like going to dinner with the guy who's like, I'm a really good guy.
Yeah.
You know,
I'm big in Japan. It's interesting. I mean, I guess it would make sense to publicize that. If Barnes & Noble coming out the number one list of anything that's not physical book retailer is good news. I mean, I don't mean that snarkily. Like, you need to use it.
Mm-hmm.
But, like, it doesn't get y'all hot and bothered to go to Barnes & Noble. Boy, are they reputable. Man, well, I'm going to go do some reputable shopping over at Big Green B&N today.
Well, and also, like, it's in the front windows. Yeah. I haven't seen this anywhere else. And so, like, by the time you see it, you've already decided you're going to Barnes & Noble. So it's like, congratulations, you're walking into the most reputable place that you had already decided you trusted enough to come here. So I was thinking about, like, you know, you could, I think you're right, you want to lasso getting this kind of title, but this is maybe what you put in, I don't know, like targeted Facebook or Google ads for people that are looking for books online, or that, you know, are shopping for retargeting is fancy. They could figure this out of like, let's try to convert some people. Like maybe you try to convert some Amazon book buyers to Barnes & Noble because Barnes & Noble is more reputable.
Yeah.
Like, it's the holidays. It's this is time to try to get people in the door that aren't typically in the doors of your store. But the, like, let us announce it to you who have already chosen to come here seemed a little like that's a little preaching to the choir, unnecessary. Like, I, you know, they just didn't quite get
no.
it, which is how I feel about a lot of Barnes & Noble's efforts.
It's also like the least sexy good thing you can say about a retail chain, right? Like, I mean, it's like the most hygienic, like, the cleanest toilets, but they're like the most reputable.
It's like, it is, it's like to go back to the date analogy. Yeah. It's like, well, tell me about yourself. Like, well, I'm very punctual.
Right. That's right.
You know, like, oh, baby.
Yeah. My sock drawer is very tidy.
I'm a recondoed the shit out of that.
It's funny, too, because then, you know, Amazon's number two. So there's a little bit of a, are you leading? You're kind of leading with your job because you want to distinguish yourself. I think if you're Barnes & Noble, Amazon's got to be your number one competitor. And they're right there next to you. Just leave it off the sign. Don't put it on there. Don't do
right,
it.
Just why not just a big banner that says number one most reputable retailer?
I think it does make me wonder a little bit, too, about this is also along the wrong vector that they're losing customers to. It's like no one's departing Barnes & Noble because, like, you know, they're so disreputable or the competitors are buying. I'm so worried about, you know, Amazon's reputability reputability. That's your ability to turn
I
think it's your ability to turn into a reptile.
Let's go with it.
But, like, it made me think what national chains that would appear on this list would I consider disreputable?
Oh,
like, I don't even think of reputation in a national chain as even a question, right? Like, if they're a national chain, I kind of implicitly, you know, they're not going to scam me. It's a giant corporation to just buy it from the store. I don't think of
it. The criteria of reputability.
Yeah. It's, like, weird. I guess maybe in the old days, CompUSA kind of got a bad reputation for trying to upsell you and having bad customer service in stores like that. Maybe like maybe it's like the Walgreens and Duane Reade. Like we just talked about W.H. Smith. They were like ranked the worst. It'd be something that's very down market in a lot of different, you know, it's very utilitarian. You know, maybe like gas stations. I don't know.
Right. Or like, yeah, like you can't get any good customer service.
Right. You don't even want to be there.
Yeah,
you don't want to be there. And I do wonder how much of the halo effect that Barnes & Noble happens to sell books and people have like a sort of
books conservative
romanticism about books. So how bad can it be? How much credit can they really take for that people like books? And I don't know. It's an odd thing. And it does connect a little bit to the W.H. Smith story in terms of relative reputations. I guess the halo effect of books can't be that great if W.H. Smith and a lot of their store sells half books and they came in dead last. Interesting to think about. But it is, it's a little bit grasping of straws. It's like we're the best company with an ampersand in our name. Number one, came out number one. Actually, Crate and Barrel might beat them, sadly.
Yeah, I'm
Ben and Jerry's,
yes.
Room and Board. We're the top five. Top five retail brands with 8% in our name.
Oh, boy. Didn't take us long to...
crap all over that one.
There we go. You know, I wish that I had a little more research time, or not had, but devoted a little more research time before the show here to figure out what this Reputation Institute is. Like, is this even a thing that matters? Or were they just like, you know what, Barnes & Noble, like, people have told us that they like you, and so will you put a banner up in your store? Like, Bob, as you know, is a financial advisor and local, it happens in Richmond. I'm sure it happens in all cities, like local magazines some local company runs some consumer driven thing of like, who are the best financial advisors or like, who are the best pediatricians or whatever. And it's a huge scam because all that they do then is they call him once a year and are like, you've been voted one of Richmond's best financial advisors. You know, do you want the full page ad in Richmond Magazine? Do you want the full page ad and the plaque? Or would you like it on a gold trophy? Like, they start with the assumption that you're going to spend, you know, a ridiculous amount of money to advertise that you've won a thing that's meaningless. Right. And I wonder how much of that is going on here.
I think there's a non-zero chance that there's some sort of pay-to-play element. Yeah, there you go. So anyway, this has been Retail Corner. Let's transition out of that a little bit. Sad news. I mean, I'm sure if you're listening to this, it was all over the place, and rightly so. Stan Lee, the great comic creator, Marvel legend, Marvel Comics co-founder. I think that's right. I was looking at my bio, and it's a little murky. I even read a whole book about the Marvel Comics. It's still a little murky, and I think it's a, on the whole, a very positive legacy. In the early days of Marvel, there was some stuff about how he got involved with comics and maybe taking credit for things he didn't do or signing deals that were advantageous to him and not, say, like famously Jack Kirby, who created the Fantastic Four. But over time was, you know, it's one of those things where in hindsight, I think in 20 years, we're like, I was alive at the same time of Stan Lee. It's like Walt Disney or someone like that. It's that that kind of influence, almost hard to hard to get a come with. Virtually every Marvel superhero you've heard of, Stan Lee has his fingers in. I think artistic, there's a commercial and there's an artistic piece to this. The commercial piece is more complicated. The artistic piece is, you know, in a nutshell, he brought human traits to superheroes. They were complicated. Mm-hmm. They had struggles. They dealt with depression. They dealt with addiction. They dealt with prejudice. They dealt with bias of all kinds. They had interpersonal difficulty. And, you know, the easiest way to see it is to look at old Superman comics and old Batman comics and see how these were superheroes, not just in terms of what they could do, but how they were as beings in the world. They were much more mythic in terms of not really having interiorities and not really having personalities, not really being relatable on a human level. But then you started to get things like, you know, Ben Grimm in the Fantastic Four, who gets changed into this rock monster hero with enormous strength and powers, but also he looks like a giant rock, and it doesn't go so well all the time if you look like a giant rock. You look at the X-Men, who are mutants, and they have these amazing powers, but they're labeled as different and are persecuted and really gets, and Peter Parker, Spider-Man, who is a, you know, maybe the most interesting or one of the most powerful superheroes in the world, but also a teenager going through what it means to be a teenager and having a secret identity. Like a lot of the metaphorical stuff is a little on the nose if you're like in a graduate seminar, but it did offer superhero stories complexity and ongoing interest beyond just look how hard we can punch this thing or look at the powers. It's the stories themselves became interesting. And, you know, the Marvel method that Stan Lee introduced, it's really interesting in terms of productivity and creativity, but the artists and writers, I know this sounds insane, didn't used to work side by side. You know, basically my understanding is, at least, email me if I'm wrong, is that the writers would go give the scripts to the artists and that would sort of be it. But he moved the artists and writers closer together physically in the studios so they could work together on stories and have visions for art and other things like that. So the modern idea of a comic book hero, and you see it in all the Marvel movies, like, you know, starting with the modern era of Marvel in 2008's Iron Man, Robert Downey Jr.'s Tony Stark is a complicated figure. He's not just a hero. He starts out sort of as a weapons dealer. He's a womanizer. He's an alcoholic. And a lot of that stuff haunts him going forward, though he tries to be better. He still carries that baggage with him into the future and sustains stories over time because the characters, I think that's a thing that Stan Lee ultimately either realized, figured out, or stumbled into, that the characters themselves have to be interesting beyond their powers, in addition to their powers. And it's very difficult not to see that the modern world of popular entertainment isn't kind of Stan Lee's grandchild to some degree. There's other grand, you know, every child has multiple grandparents, but I think Stan Lee's a big one of them. So there's my, you know, brief memorial, a tribute, nutshell obituary to Stan Lee, 95 years old. Incredible, incredible legacy, and one that I think only in time will we be able to get our heads around at all.
Yeah, I think that's true. I don't have much familiarity with Stan Lee, only, you know, passing familiarity with comics, and most of my familiarity with Marvel characters is from the movies mm-hmm. and from, you know, I can spot Stan Lee doing his cameo in any yes. of the movies. But I think you're right that the scope of his influence already seems huge. Like all kinds of people in my social feeds yeah. were talking about the impact of his work on their lives, and some of them were people that I was pretty surprised mm-hmm. to see sharing that, which I thought was really cool. But I do think it's one of those that we won't know for, you know, 20 or 30 or 50 years, like really what the threads out of this influence yeah. were and how big the influence is. A really incredible life.
Incredible legacy. And again, it's complicated. There's I'll put a link in the show notes to the story of Marvel that I read, and I think if you're interested in, you know, the history of 20th century pop culture and comics and Stan Lee, it's really worth reading. Really well done. And, you know, warts and all. You know, he's a human.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, of course.
So there's that. Let's do good news. Can we ring a BR bell for a minute?
Oh yeah, we're going to ring the BR bell. We don't get to like toot our own horns all that often, I don't think, but we want to throw some confetti and wave some Muppet arms and just be thrilled for our colleague, Kelly Jensen, one of the editors of Book Riot, edits anthology collections, wonderful, timely anthology collections with Algonquin, and had a collection out just a few months ago called Don't Call Me Crazy, 33 Voices Start the Conversation About Mental Health. It's intended for young adult readers and older, ages 14 and up, and it was named just this week as one of the Washington Post's 10 best children's books of 2018.
Hey, hey.
Hey, hey. Kelly, there are so many fascinating writers in among these 33 voices from just a really diverse breadth of experience, of identity, of background, and of the different kinds of mental health struggles that they've dealt with. And it's so I think all the voices are just very honest. It's very refreshing to hear people speak so openly about something that continues to be stigmatized in our society, and that we just always need more conversation about mental health, and about that this is part of being human. And if you don't experience it yourself, your life will certainly be touched by it in some way with someone that you know. And so being able to talk about these varieties of experience and take the shame out of them and restructure the conversation is just so vital. It's a wonderful book, and I know I and you couldn't be prouder mm-hmm. of Kelly or happier to see this happen. So I think also we'll preemptively put this on the list for the holiday
yes.
recommendation request, that if there is anyone in your life, and I'm sure there is, that could benefit from a reframing or just hearing that they're not alone in experiencing these things. Don't Call Me Crazy, edited by Kelly Jensen. Congrats, Kelly.
Congrats, Kelly. Well deserved. Let's go on to more award winners. This, I think, will bring to an end the Jeff and Rebecca Shruggy Parade around 2018 awards. 2018 Shruggy Parade's a good show title.
I was just like writing it down as you said.
The National Book Awards were announced last night.
Mm-hmm.
I think a lot of notable things to say here. You know, I think the best picture version, you know, the one that gets the most attention, mm-hmm. most people are paying attention to, is the winner for best novel. Just there's best for fiction, mm-hmm. no YA, you know, yeah. anything else like that. Sigrid Nunez won for The Friend, which I had not read the blurb. Did you read the blurb about this morning?
No.
Mm-mm. I'm going to read it right now, and then
tell me.
React what I said. when a woman unexpectedly loses her lifelong best friend and mentor, she finds herself burdened with an unwanted dog he has left behind. Her own battle against grief is intensified by the mute suffering of the dog, a huge Great Dane traumatized by the inexplicable disappearance of its master, and by the threat of eviction. Dogs are prohibited in her apartment building. While others worry that grief has made her a victim of magical thinking, the woman refuses to be separated from the dog except for the brief periods of time. Isolated from the rest of the world, increasingly obsessed with the dog's care, determined to read its mind and fathom its heart, she comes dangerously close to unraveling. But while troubles abound, rich and surprising rewards lie in store for both of them. That's pretty interesting.
That does sound interesting.
We've got one question, though. You know what the question is here?
No.
Does the dog die?
Oh, let us know.
Yeah, if anyone knows, we won't I guess we don't want to announce on the show because it's a spoiler, but maybe you could email us and ask.
For my own knowledge, yes. I would like to
know. You're not the only one. Like, the trigger warnings people get are, of course, sexual assault, stuff happening to kids, and does the dog die or the pet die? Like,
yeah.
That makes sense to me.
It won't keep me from reading the book. I would just like to know.
Yeah, it's a content warning that's not a trigger warning, right? That you want to have some control over what kinds of stories you consume.
How sad am I going to be today?
Yeah, right. Like, you know, is this a 2-alarm snot bomb, a 5-alarm snot? Like, where? What, you know, what DEFCON are we on? What mucus bomb are we really talking about here? So that's the Head and Shoulders one. The other winners. I'm so glad to see Jeffrey C. Stewart win for nonfiction for The New Negro: The Life of Elaine Locke. In poetry, Justin Philip Reed wins for Indecency. In the translated literature category, Margaret Mitsutani wins for the translation award for her translation of The Emissary by Yoko Tawada, translated from the Japanese. And then I think this is probably the one we might have put our chips on if we were betting people for young adult. Elizabeth Acevedo wins for The Poet X. And because we count and we pay attention, all people of color.
Yes.
I'm sure that's not a mistake.
Is that the first time that's happened in National Book Award history?
I would frankly be surprised if it has happened before. But
yeah, same.
But this, you know, Lisa Lucas, who is the executive director over there, I think she has systemically put in place the ability for this to happen, or at the very least, the ability that people are getting nominated based on, they're not getting left out for structural reasons. Let's put it that way. Amazing award.
Very exciting.
Anything else you want to say about this? Again,
no,
we don't know anything.
It's the shruggy, it's the shruggy parade, and we're not reading fiction this year.
And I never read poetry, and I very rarely read YA. So there we go.
I will probably, you know, I perpetually pick up the National Book Award poetry winners with very good intentions, and then very rarely actually get through all of them for me. It's definitely me, it's not them. But I'm probably going to pick up Indecency, and I've had The Poet X. YA has been an exception to the can't really read fiction this year rule, so I'm probably going to give that one a shot.
I think I'm going to be paying attention. I knew at the time that I was excited about the translated award. This is the first year it's been given, but reading the blurb for The Emissary is also fascinating. We'll put a link in the show notes. I won't read the blurb here, but it's sort of a post-disaster Japan speculative fiction, not quite a dystopia. Without having read it, I don't know if I'd be wrong or right in labeling it a dystopia, but it sounds super interesting. A fable-like speculative fiction about a post-disaster Japan sounds really interesting as well.
Yeah.
I think for me, as someone who likes fiction, likes, for lack of a better term, literary fiction, right? God help us all. and I'm looking for gatekeeping the world put a sticker on some of these for me to pick out when I'm looking for literature from around the world. And this is a good one.
Yeah.
I'm looking forward to that. Let's do a sponsor. You want to tell me about a sponsor?
All right. Yes. Our next sponsor this week is In Half by Yasmin Frelich. This is millennials, but at 50. In a world they did not want. The characters here, right, are close friends from their youth, a poet, a theater director, and an ex-minister of war, each on their own continent, each in a different political setting, and now they are grappling with the uncertain realities of a disconnected world. 25 years in the future, a glitch in the global communications network is ripping a previously united world apart at the seams. The millennials find themselves hardest hit, trapped in a crumbling world they did not want, and as they each prepare to celebrate their 50th birthdays, the friends desperately try to recapture the magic of their former lives and hold on to some sort of sense of belonging. It's very timely. It's a satirical look at society today and imagining where we'll be 25 years from now, about the importance of technology and our reliance on technology. And it opens up questions about global communication and about the future of our society. So if that sounds interesting to you, it certainly sounds interesting to me. It's In Half. If you're searching for it online, it's In/Half by Yasmin Frelich. And we'll have a link in the show notes.
I don't remember that we did this last year. Publishers Weekly, Publishing Industry Sellers.
Yeah.
Did we do it last year?
We do it every year, yeah.
And maybe it's just that the story stays the same.
That's exactly
that
what
I
it
don't,
is.
Don't know. Publishers Weekly released, last week. It's annual industry salary survey for the publishing industry that isn't just salaries. It's demographics of people that work and where they work. Even though it's called the salary survey, the infographic that PW leads with kind of is the story in a lot of ways. That's not exactly true. I think it's interesting that's the one they led with, even though it's a salary survey and this first infographic has nothing to do with salaries. It's racial makeup of publishing. Long story short, it's like modern kitchens. They're mostly white. White Caucasian, 86%. Asian, 4%. Hispanic, 4%. Mixed race, 3%. Black African American, 2%. And other 1%. I think it's helpful to remember. Sometimes people see this and they know rightly that, you know, America's mostly white, so shouldn't this be mostly white? Well, America's about 63% white. Okay. And so this is 33% more white than the nation as a whole. And the one that sticks out the most to me, because I happen to have this stat in front of mine, is the Black African American is 2%, which is like 6 times less than it would be if this were, you know, indexed to the American population at large. And it just hasn't moved, man. Like, it's down a percentage point from 2016 for all the talk. And we have talked a lot about, you know, we just talked about the National Book Award. We see improvement on the lists, the catalogs. I think we haven't seen a big survey of catalogs, but like the lists and these things, I feel like the We Need Diverse movement has made inroads. We Need Diverse Books movement, pardon me. But the people with their butts in chairs in New York, those people haven't changed, it doesn't seem like.
They haven't, that it's only, the publishing is only 1% whiter than 1% white, 1% less white than it was last year is, it just really hasn't moved. And there's a really telling paragraph in the middle of this piece that says, diversifying the workforce seems to be more important to people of color than it is to white industry members. Though 53% of non-white respondents said that strides have been made in diversifying publishing's ranks. Let's see, only 38% said no progress has been made, and only 9% said they don't know whether things have improved. And there are so few non-white people in the industry that in order to diversify the workforce, this has to change. Like, this is the thing that has to change, is white people have to decide that they care enough about diversifying the workforce to do something about it. And some of that means, you know, actively changing the pipeline, actively promoting, hiring and promoting people of color, paying attention to these kinds of things. And some of it might mean then doing so with the recognition that you may ultimately give up an opportunity for yourself, because you're, you know, trying to put different people in the seats at the table. And like, I think publishing is still, I mean, you can see here by age and gender breakdowns, like publishing is very white. Publishing is relatively, like, it's not the youngest of industries. And if this is going to move at all, like, this movement can't just occur at the bottom.
No.
You know, it can't just occur with the young non-white people who are doing the vast majority of the work to raise these issues and to make them public and to rally for change. But for the change to actually happen, policy has to be made around it and new systems have to be put in place. And that can only come from the top. And the vast majority of the people at the top are white. So they have to decide that they care. And I guess the only positive thing about this is that Publishers Weekly is hanging a real lantern on it. You know, this sentence, like the opening sentence of the piece, is change comes slowly to the publishing industry, despite years of the discussion about the need to bring more people of color into the workforce. It's only down, the whiteness is only down 1% from 2016. And then noting that, you know, diversifying it seems to matter a whole lot more to the people who aren't white than it does to people who are white. So this is a real, you know, put your money and your policy and your time where your mouth is moment, but it's very disappointing. Not surprising. Very disappointing. Yeah.
And the respondents seem to echo the sense you and I have that on the title level, things have improved. I don't think we're at the promised land yet, but this is a quote directly from the piece. In terms of improving the diversity of titles, 78% of all respondents said improvement has been made. 79% of white respondents said improvement has been made. And 73% of people of color said improvement is made on the title level. So that's, I guess that maybe is a spot of good news there. But a much higher proportion of non-white respondents, 20%, than white respondents, 6%, said they feel no improvement in title diversity has been made. The story is a little bit more mixed. Maybe you can see the tide turning to some degree when it comes to gender and pay and management. Still mm-hmm. a significant, I don't want to undersell, still a significant pay gap. The average salary for men who responded to the survey was $87,000 compared to $60,000 for women. So that's still a $27,000 disparity. That's improved $1,000 from last year. As we said, the higher ups, it's going to have to get people in the higher up positions, and that seems to be happening. Women closed the pay gap in the management ranks by $3,000. And according mm-hmm. to the survey, 59% of management jobs were held by women in 2017, up from 49% in 2016. So we went from women being less than half to more mm-hmm. than half by, you know, almost 6 in 10 management jobs are held by women. At least I should say that with the caveat that this is people who responded. So, mm-hmm. so there's change being made there. I would guess, if our theory of this is sort of right, that as women hold more and more management positions, the pay gap for women all up and down the line in publishing will start to narrow as well.
Well, here's hoping.
But, you know, this is one thing that people who talk about intersectional feminism tend to note, is that things get better for white women while things for people of color and women of color don't. And that's not progress, really. That's not the whole story. And sometimes white women, and forget about white men for a second, we're just a disaster. But for the moment, let's talk about white women for a second, about sometimes the pulling yourself up and pulling each other up doesn't include women of color, doesn't include people of color. And that's something that seems to be happening a little bit in publishing mm-hmm. here.
Yeah, I think that's true. You know, that I think we're seeing a couple big things here. And one is that certainly there are improvements and changes in gender balance, gender equity, in a way that is not happening with racial equity mm-hmm. in publishing. Women are getting more opportunities. People of color are not getting any more measurable opportunities by a measure of the size and makeup of the workforce. And those two things don't always happen at the same times in society, but they do impact each other. And I think that that is the top line, that this is a thing that does happen, is like the feminist movement occurs, white women get a bunch of new rights. It continues to be really difficult to be a woman of color. You're doubly marginalized as a woman and as a person of color in this country. And that if white women don't do the rest of the work, and like true feminism, I believe, is intersectional and wants equality for all women, that when we're talking about like, well, now if you're in a place of power in publishing and you're white, you have to start caring, or, you know, if you say you care, mm-hmm. you have to start acting on that care to create opportunities for people of color, especially for women, and that the halls of power in publishing are starting to be occupied by more women in management positions means it's on these women mm-hmm. who are largely white to do this work and to, you know, not require that the marginalized people in the lower rungs of the industry have to fight their way up. That change can occur that way, but that's not the way that change should occur. And if you have benefited from, you know, institutional changes and from activism in some way, and you're a white woman now who has a position of power and some access, it is on you mm-hmm. to continue the work. You don't get to stop caring just because you got the new rights.
And I don't want to gloss over that, you know, white men still have the most ability to change the dynamics here. That's still, you know, mm-hmm. the most clout still lays there. And we've got work to do. And especially if you care about doing this at all, you know, the scales are still on a lot of our eyes here. I think by highlighting that white women seem to be benefiting from a sea change, mm-hmm. I think a lot of these women are probably well-intentioned. A lot of the people, I would guess, I'm just saying the intentions are good. I think what's hard to understand, it's still hard for me to understand, is that even as you are advocating for gender equity, you can still fall prey to the same kinds of systemic and cultural racism that white men are so fluent in, let's put it that way. Just because you're fighting for gender equality doesn't mean you don't have the same biases that led to white men having those kinds of racial biases.
Yeah.
That it takes double. They don't necessarily. They're not causally linked. They don't go hand in hand, right, in a way that you think they might. They just don't.
Yeah.
And it takes extra attention.
I think. Right, and you're right to point out that their intentions are probably good, mm-hmm, or at least not intent. They don't have intentions for ill. But I think that it's like when Obama got elected and people were like, well, there's a black man in the White House, so we must be in a post-racial,
right,
society.
Yeah, uh-huh.
You know,
look how
if
that
you
turned
can point
out,
to
turned
like,
out great.
Right. That if you can point to, well, that we have, you know, more women in management positions, or if you are a woman who, like, you've gotten some promotions and maybe all your bosses are women and you're a white woman looking around, seeing women who look like you in positions of power through structural and institutional forces, you might think like, oh, well, okay, so we're done. You know, like, mm-hmm, we're done with sexism. This is fine. When really the women of color around you are still being affected by sexism and by racism.
Yeah, it's tough.
They're not the, like, overt, vocal, you can't have this job because you're a black woman. Mm-hmm. It's much more subtle and insidious than that, which makes it harder to root out and harder to change. And I just know and believe that that comes from the top. So I don't know, Jeff, maybe next year.
Well, I think that women in management, I mean, maybe that's the first, domino that has to fall in deconstructing some of these things. Like maybe it's too much to ask, or it's unreasonable to ask, or it's an order of operations thing where, you know, chipping away and chipping away and chipping away at the inequity in the seats at the table and the pay.
Well,
I don't know, but like, I don't think it's I think that kind of thinking leads to people think, well, the first domino fell, so the other ones are going to think. I think it's possible,
right,
in this situation, you hit the first domino, mm-hmm, and that's white,
exactly,
women, and it hits the next one, it just stays there. It just falls. It
right,
just
like
sits
you can,
there.
You can only promote who you already have.
That's right.
In the room.
Yeah.
And so I think that's at work here, that there were a lot,
yeah,
of white women,
point,
in publishing, you know, and those white women are getting promotions. But if this is going to change, it has to be that there are more people of color in the room.
Yeah.
Publishers have to be hiring more people of color so that the next dominoes can fall, so that then they can promote more people of color and really do this, mm-hmm, that perhaps those second all the secondary dominoes haven't fallen because there aren't enough people in the room for them to fall.
Yeah.
Like there's not critical, and that's a real problem, that the industry very likely doesn't have enough people of color in it to, you know, to accurately and fully represent people, mm-hmm, of color up and down the ladders of power in these businesses. So
yeah,
right, well,
I mean, it could be that, you know, 1% for 10 years is 10%, and then you're at 76%, mm-hmm, and it's looking, again, it's also hard to know that sometimes politics and cultural change is the screwing of hard nails into hard wood, and it takes time and effort, and it doesn't happen overnight in a way that we might want to. So I think watching the vector of change is important. Like, this switch in women in management, I think, is, I don't want to undersell that. 49 to 56, like there's a worm turning moment there. Like that's a pretty big change, mm-hmm, for 1 year. Now, if you just got promoted to management, are you more interested in filling out a survey about your job? That's a second, you know, that's another question. There's a lot of methodology corners, things we could do here. Lastly, I don't know if we want to spend too much time on this because I don't know that's that different than culture at large about sexual harassment. Mm. 18% of respondents said that they had been sexually harassed in the context of their job. I don't know what the writ large number is. I don't know if what I would have guessed if I was asked to guess what number.
Oh,
that feels right to me, weirdly. I'd be curious to hear what you had to say about that number.
Well, I mean, I think the answer to this question for, I think that this number comes out of the fact that both men and women are answering.
That's right. There you go.
And that if you ask women and non-binary folks,
mm-hmm,
basically if you ask people who aren't cishet guys,
yeah,
have you been sexually harassed, period, the answer is almost 100% mm-hmm. in some context. Have you been sexually harassed in the context of your job? I would put it over 50% for women. It depends on how people, of course, define sexual harassment for themselves or what they think their company's policies are. But I think that asking this question and lumping men and women's responses together obscures the truth of the size of the issue. And this is not like that's not specific to publishing, right. but it's like if the Harvey Weinstein news had broken and a newspaper had done a piece about this and had been like, well, we asked 10,000 people if they've been sexually harassed and here are the answers. That's not indicative of the problem. sexual harassment is largely pointed at women. And so to say, well, only 18%, like, I don't believe this number, okay. basically.
Well, the number is probably accurate of what there is. I mean, I don't think they're misrepresenting the data they got, but the way it's structured.
Oh, right. Yes. I think this is a bad question. Yeah. Like, to put it into methodology corner, this is a bad question. Mm-hmm. Or you should break out the yes and no responses by the gender and, frankly, also the race of the people answering the question.
I think the most interesting part of this whole thing, I mean, I guess the part that got my ears perked up was they included a section of, they had basically an open blank spot in the survey for people to give comments on sexual harassment. And they included, I don't know if these are representative, they don't really understand, they selected some of the comments we received. So if they're indicative or not, they're actual respondents about sexual harassment. And I would encourage you, if you're interested in this, to follow the link in the show notes. You scroll to the bottom and you could see. And I think the tenor of these comments is best encapsulated by this following one. Sexual harassment is rife within the industry, but even more rife at my company is sexual discrimination unrelated to actual sexual acts. Simply being a male makes you less likely to get promoted at middle management levels and has been acknowledged as social economic justice by my HR department in the past. A weird comment, right? I think there's a bifurcated thinking going on there that I think is indicative of a moment of a transition. I think that's fair, but also really telling that, like, sexual harassment is right, but dudes are discriminated against. Like, that's clearly a situation.
Well,
and then you look at the rest of the comments and they're all, this is still a big problem. It doesn't get reported and things don't happen. And yet there's resistance still to take the whole situation seriously. I just find it fascinating.
Of course there is.
Yeah, like, I guess
that,
so.
You know, men who have had access to all of the opportunities in the past perceive other people getting access to those opportunities as a loss to them.
Mm-hmm.
And hashtag not all men. You know,
yeah.
Like, don't send me your emails about how you're a good
congratulations.
Guy. Yada, yada, whatever.
Yeah.
Right. But like that a company actively promotes women or focuses on creating opportunities for people who aren't just men, like that is a form of social and economic justice. And I don't think that's a bad thing. But like reverse sexism doesn't exist. Reverse racism, like these are not things. And that this comment is essentially, my company is reverse sexist because I'm a dude and women are getting middle management spots that I think I should have gotten priority for. And I don't get priority anymore. Mm. It's really, you're losing priority. You know, he could still get promoted, but he doesn't have the same assumed priority that he previously had just by virtue of maleness. And then you're right. The rest of the comments is just a string of, you know, despite all the open-faced policies large publishing houses seem to tout, there are cover-ups and complaints going unheeded, managers spreading stories about employees who have told them vulnerable information in strict confidence, a lack of allies in upper management. You know, responses to specific instances over the past year, but I don't believe the industry is actually invested in changing the climate. I think this one's a very telling comment. It's, quote, when it comes down to it, it will be a cost-benefit analysis, and if a house or agency or other arm can get by without significantly hurting their bottom line, incidents are going to get swept under the carpet again. When the harasser is high profile, public statements are made and noticed by everyone, and we agree we're doing a good job. When it's someone lower profile or internal, most of the time it seems like there really isn't any punishment at all. Here's one that I I know to be true from stories that I have heard from folks is if an author's book is selling well, management turns a blind eye to any complaints of sexual harassment. The same is true if the individual in management is well-liked. The complaints are always brushed off or laughed off. And we know of folks in really high, powerful positions at publishers with like a good half dozen at least stories that I could rattle off about them, that it just doesn't seem like anything is ever going to happen. And that's either like maybe settlements and non-disclosure agreements have occurred. Maybe the publisher just doesn't care, but there are some that are high profile enough that I have to believe that the people at the top are aware and are choosing not to do anything about it.
There is a part of it that feels like the old, I think this used to happen more in car companies than it does now, but if they'd find a flaw in the safety of the brakes of, you know, an old car, and I'm not going to name a brand name because I really don't want to get sued into oblivion, but you know, they figure out like, okay, a recall is going to cost us X amount of dollars. And just paying settlements for the people that get hurt in these crashes is going to cost us less, so we'll just go with that, right? They're solving for the bottom line rather than some other vector that we might hope they would solve for, and that seems to be happening here. I think the expression of frustration is interesting. It's useful. It's probably a precondition of change happening. But as you know, we said before, we'd like to see this happening. I think one thing that comes through this, and I feel like this to be true to writ large, is that existing corporate policy is not equipped to handle this world of sexual harassment.
Yeah.
It's just corporate HR policy doesn't anticipate things like this, where there may not be smoking guns. They don't have clauses built into it. There's not like malfeasance clauses around sexual harassment. You know, it's sort of beyond the scope of what companies themselves are equipped to deal with. They don't have the tools to deal with it. So like reporting it to their tools doesn't help because they don't know what to do with it. It's like, you give me really nice ingredients to cook with. I still can't make something good because I don't know how to cook. I just don't. I don't know what to do with it.
They don't want like, I think that one part of this too is that publishing, and I think it's part like emblematic of publishing being slow to change at all, is that publishers don't want the PR disaster of, you know, executive or head of imprint or whatever gets fired for sexual harassment. And that means that they don't understand yet that a headline like that is to their benefit.
Ultimately, I think it would be.
I think so too. Like in the moment of this movement that we're in right now, a giant company firing someone in a position of power over sexual misconduct is a point in that company's favor. Mm-hmm. Like, that's not a PR disaster. This is a good PR moment for you. If there is someone you should be firing for this, you should fire them and you should tell everyone that you have done it. It establishes trust among the people who work for you, and it establishes trust among your consumers and among people who might come work for you. And it's just the right thing to do. But publishers also have the trickiness of they're not just dealing with the folks who work inside the publishing house. They have all these external factors with authors as well of what do you do about that? And one of the remarks here is that companies need policies to deal with authors who harass
their employees. Well, the morality clause we talked about previously, right? Like, how can you do something about that?
Yeah, and that these should be built into contracts. Like, if you're a publicist and you have to accompany an author to a bunch of appearances and that author harasses you, but he's in a, you know, he's one of your company's big deals. Mm-hmm. What are you supposed to do? Like, they're probably not going to cancel his contract. So you can either keep doing your job or you can get taken off that account.
Yeah. I mean, just to use a real life example, think of how the story about the firing of Demos Parneros would have been different if Barnes & Noble, who we think has receipts based on what we've seen about countersuits, if they really had the receipts on that dude, and they were firing him for the reason they say they are, or as part of it, is like, this guy was creating an unhealthy, toxic work environment to our staff as a sexual harasser, and he's got to go. Boy, think of how that story would have been different.
Yeah.
Really been different. And I don't want to be Machiavellian about it, but like, I think that's something that people should consider and think about this.
Well, I think the age of the cover-up benefiting you is over.
Yeah. Yeah,
That's really what it comes down to.
The cover-up, it implies that the cover-up was going to work in the long term, which I think probably it won't.
No, I think we're past the point of, like, now if there's, I mean, always, but now especially, if a cover-up, if you know this stuff and you cover it up or you don't take action, it's going to come out. And when it comes out, you look worse. Yeah. And you really do have an opportunity to look decent.
Right.
You know, like,
it's never too late to do the right thing. That's what, I mean, that's
right,
the old saying. Let's do another sponsor and maybe I don't know if it's happier, but like different kinds of stories. The Great Courses Plus is back. If you love to learn new things, you'll have so much fun exploring The Great Courses Plus. It's a video and streaming service that helps you discover new interests, pick up new hobbies. Maybe I could learn something about, well, anything that I don't already know about, which is most things, really. With fascinating insight from leading professors and experts, you get unlimited access to thousands of lectures in virtually any category, like literature, history, science, cooking, and photography, and much more, because those aren't all the categories. There's more than those five. We recommend checking out the course, Life Lessons from the Great Books. Professor Rufus Fears draws you into the world of masterpieces like Macbeth, Brave New World, The Odyssey, and more, exploring the wisdom that can be gleaned from each story. When I used to teach a Great Books course, and we did the history of Western literature from Homer to Virginia Woolf in the course of a year, the thing that really made the older books stick is that how many of them still felt like they were wrestling with questions that, you know, in refracted and reflected over time, still feel like they're relevant. These are questions humans have been wrestling with since they knew even that there were questions to wrestle with. You know, the Odyssey, what do you owe your country? What do you owe your colleagues? What do you owe your partner in life? Can they be gone for 20 years and you're supposed to sit there and wait and like weave the whole time like Penelope did? What do you have to do to protect your family? Is that reasonable? What do you owe your neighbor? What do you owe your God, your spiritual belief? Like, how much of yourself do you have to sacrifice for others? And it's all there from the very beginning. And this course walks you through those questions over time. Right now, you can start enjoying the Great Courses Plus for free, with an entire month of unlimited access to enjoy all of their lectures. To get this special limited time offer, go to thegreatcoursesplus.com/bookriot. That's thegreatcoursesplus.com/bookriot to start your free month. Okay, this is follow-up that...
All right.
It must have been announced earlier. You put this in there. I didn't see this, but kind of went out with a whimper rather than a bang.
For a while, I think earlier this year, we were tracking that Aaron Sorkin is doing a stage adaptation of To Kill a Mockingbird, and folks associated with the Harper Lee's estate were objecting to it, and there was going to be, like, it was going to court, and they were actually going to stage a reading of the play in court so that the judge could make a determination. That must have happened, and the judge must have decided that it's fine, because there's a piece in Entertainment Weekly online this week, and we'll have a link to the full piece in the show notes. The piece is about how Aaron Sorkin adapted To Kill a Mockingbird into being, you know, more appropriate for 2018, but buried in here is that the play is set to open on December 13th. So that's happening. It's going forward. We're just closing the loop. I'm sad that we did not get like a breakdown account of what happened in that courtroom when they performed the play. But yeah, my notes on the podcast agenda were like, this is happening because apparently it was fine. So
yeah, it's going on. I guess that the Lee estate protested so much makes me way more interested in this than I would have been had they not. And there's a little bit of a Streisand effect going on here.
Yeah, I was thinking the same. Like, I'm not terribly interested in seeing this, but I'm more interested than I would have been otherwise.
I'm not exactly clear. It sounds like that Scout and Dill and Jem are being played by adults as their adult selves, and that there's a frame of the story, you know, the main action of To Kill a Mockingbird, but it's played through a lens of time. So that's interesting. I'll be curious to see the theater craft part of it. I find to be interesting about like how they're dealing with, because they said they didn't want 12 and 13 year olds playing. They didn't want them to be the leads for reasons I'm not sure are right ultimately and couldn't be done, but I kind of understand, right? But that the book is told through the lens of memory, right? When he was 13, my brother Jem broke his arm just above the elbow. That's an older scout looking back on, as we know from Ghost at a Watchman, an older scout is a sort of thing in the Harper Lee universe that exists. So it makes some sense to think of it this way. I'd be curious to see as a, you know, just a storytelling mode, what's going on here. Interesting choice for Sorkin. Doesn't adapt other people's artistic works very often. He will adapt nonfiction, right? He'll work on that to create a story. But something that's overtly already a story, I don't know that I've seen before. I'm sure if I went and looked at the IMDb page, but this is the highest profile. Also not a movie. I don't know if this is a preamble to, if this goes well, there's a movie version of this, which would be interesting to think about. But certainly in the world of Harper Lee, To Kill a Mockingbird news, this is way more interesting to me than the regression to the mean PBS selection of To Kill a Mockingbird. So there's that follow-up for everyone. It opens December 13th. Go get tickets if you can. I'm sure it'll be a very difficult ticket to get, but we'll see. I'll be curious to see about the reviews. I wanted to, Happy Muppet Arms. We don't do this very often. We could maybe do this more if we wanted to. Book news, release news that
yes.
We've been waiting. We wait for, this is unfair. Writers write at their own pace. It's not fair to say we've been anxious, but we're looking forward to the next Aaron Morgenstern book. Like whenever it was going to come is fine. And in November 2019, her next novel after The Night Circus will be released, called The Starless Sea. And it's a wholly original love story set in a secret underground world.
Yes.
We'll put a link to the show notes. That even the cover they have here is provisional. Like, it's actually not a bad cover as these things go, but there's going to be something else. Michelle, when I texted her this information, her immediate response was, will it be narrated by Jim Dale? I think it's a wonderful question. As many longtime listeners of the show know, there's a bingo square that is the Jim Dale's narration of The Night Circus is something we talk about for reasons I will defend to my dying breath. But there we go. New novel from Aaron Morgenstern.
Very exciting news. And I think not just because The Night Circus was so wonderful and people have been, you know, excited for whatever Aaron Morgenstern will do next, but that book, like, it occupies such an interesting place in readers' imaginations.
Yes.
And also, like, people ask us, you know, what can I read that's like The Night Circus? And you kind of don't have anything. Mm. It's really hard to find a read-alike for that book. But it's also so widely readable and recommendable that, expectations, I think high hopes for Aaron Morgenstern for what this next book could do. But I'm excited to see whatever it is.
I wouldn't have been shocked either if her next book would have been set in the world of The Night Circus, maybe different characters, but sort of using the same world building and mythology. And this isn't. This is unrelated, which I think is brave. It would have been easy, understandable at all to do, like, you know, from the wizarding world of J.K. Rowling, you know, from the Night Circus world of Aaron Morgenstern to do the same thing.
But to
branch out, I think, is really brave and really exciting.
To create a whole new world. Yeah, I'm really excited for that. That's Muppet Arms. And then we'll throw some brief Muppet Arms also for Michelle Obama's book Becoming, which came out this week and went on to have Barnes & Noble announced on Monday that they had the most pre-order sales for it of any adult book since Go Set a Watchman, which Go Set a Watchman went on to have Barnes & Noble's largest first day sales in history.
A long time. Yeah.
Is just, Becoming is just taking off. I haven't seen any numbers. Like, right now we're recording on Thursday. The book has been out for 2 days.
Well, we'll start to get lists next
We'll start
over
to
the
get
weekend.
Numbers in the next week. But it's everywhere. My Instagram feed, which certainly there's some echo chamber stuff happening there, but my social feeds are full of people reading it. I'm reading it. Amanda and I are going to see her this weekend.
Star-studded book tour. $1,000 of tickets on StubHub to get seats to the New York stuff.
I did not pay $1,000.
No, I mean, that's not sticker price. That's just like aftermarket. People want
to
go and they're trying to go see her.
But it's possible that I might die of joy. And so if that happens, it's been a really nice run.
Yeah, it's nice to know you.
Yeah.
Not a bad way to depart this mortal coil on the whole, if you had to do it that way.
I have to say, like, I want to see this book take the number one spot for the year, and not just because I love Michelle Obama and want to see her be successful and widely read, but I think that it would do morale. It would do some things for my morale and feelings about the world if the number one book of the year weren't a book called Fear about Donald Trump.
That'd
you
be
know,
an
like
interesting
if it could
story,
be
yeah.
something positive and inspiring.
For something than against something, kind of an idea.
Something encouraging, something positive that we can actually celebrate as the best-selling book of the year. Like, that would be nice.
I am afraid the only thing I think it would have a chance. I'm afraid it's a little late in the year. Like the advantage some of the other books had, they've had the whole year, and that those weeks of 2,000, 3,000, 4,000 sales. Now, if she sells 1 million copies in the first week, all bets are off. Then you're off the chart a little bit, but Fear had incredible sales and continues to sell. It just has more time to run. So that would be the only thing.
That's true.
We maybe could have a moral victory, even if there's not sort of a, if it's the fastest selling book of the year, maybe
right.
we'll take
yeah,
that.
Sure.
It's kind of like the Democrats taking the House. It didn't take the whole thing, but like it's a sign of tides.
There were a lot of pre-order campaigns for Becoming from indie bookstores and from big retailers. The publisher did a lot of work around it. Like, I think it could happen. I'm not going to be crushed if it doesn't happen, but I would like to see something that's not a book about Trump be the best book.
Again,
or not best, but best.
We've been doing this almost 300 episodes. So I feel like I've lived in this world for a long enough time that me figuring or learning something isn't just a sign that, like, you know, I fell off the turnip truck yesterday necessarily, which sometimes I try to acknowledge if that's a thing. I feel like the word pre-order in the book business is a much bigger deal than it was when we started doing this. I don't know if that's true, but I just feel like maybe it's because of technology. People don't have to go into the store or call in. They can just do it online. But like, there's a lot of talk from authors about the best thing you could do is pre-order my book and whatever. I just feel like there's more attention and awareness about the power and utility of pre-ordering there was.
Right. I was going to say, I think it's always been important, but authors and publishers have a lot more ways to make it happen now.
Yeah.
Like in my bookseller days, which are now a decade ago, we would, and that was just was during Twilight, like we would run pre-order campaigns in Barnes & Noble for like whatever the next Twilight book coming out was, or there were a couple Harry Potter releases as well. And the store was promoting them of like, pre-order your copy, make sure you get it. And I think that was kind of where it started and stopped. But now with social media and sort of direct contact with your readers, being able to encourage them to do it means the pre-order numbers are way bigger.
Right. Well, and frankly, I mean, go back to, we talked about the Morgenstern, you can find out about a book coming out a year from now in a way that would have been difficult in 1991, unless you happened to be in a bookstore and they knew, like, I haven't clicked through, but I wouldn't be surprised if on Amazon right now there's a page for The Starless Sea that you could go pre-order right now.
Mm-hmm.
And so it gets, you know, as you know, I know this is going to be a shock to you. I'm interested in publishing history. I don't know if you know this about me. And it makes me wonder, like, what's like the long history of, in 1941, we're like, or 1937, were people pre-ordering Gone with the Wind before it came out? I'd love to know that. It's a fascinating story.
Oh, yeah, no, I don't think so.
Anyway, that's our show. Emails podcast@bookriot.com. Holiday recommendation request. That's our number one, request. Or it's a request, weirdly. We're getting meta now. It's request all the way down. You can find links to this, the links we talked about in this episode and to our great sponsors at bookriot.com/listen. We're going to talk to you guys on the other side of Thanksgiving for all those of you celebrating out there. I hope you get some time to yourself to do the things that make you happy. Rebecca, I'll talk to you later.
Have a good one.